I don't know if you've listened to my podcast before, but sometimes there's a bit of explicit language, and this is one of those times. It's Friday, January 26th, 2018. From Slate, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. I listened to a Ross Douthat podcast twice in the last couple days. Not the same one, two different ones. He was on with Tyler Cowen, love that podcast, and David Axelrod. Rule of thumb, if you're on with Chotner, the Axe, convos with Tyler, I'll throw Larry Wilmore, Preet Bharara, and Ezra Klein. You talk to any of those guys, you show up on between two and five of them, I will listen to you three or four times. I'm not even a huge Ross Douthat fan. Douthat, he's been on the show. Nice guy, smart guy. But the thing is, Ross Douthat, New York Times columnist, is very, very concerned with religion and Catholicism, and I just don't care that much. I like theology, okay. Hey, what do you believe in? What are the dietary restrictions? Heaven? Okay. Hell? Reincarnation? I like the basics. Sketch it out for me. I go next level, but not deep down to the next level. Interesting? Swordfish. Kosher or not kosher? I'm game. Transubstantiation of the Eucharist. Sure. Let me know about that. Did the lineage of Muhammad flow through his nephew/son-in-law or the caliphate? Yes, I'd like to know. But deeper than that, I don't, you know what? That's kind of among you people. So Douthat, he's often picking apart issues of theology that don't interest me as much as actual, tangible, real-world issues do. They're deep and they're brilliant, but it's all pretend, right? It's all this deep arguing over picayune points over inherently something that's pretend. I don't want to insult you if that's your religion, but, you know, if I were to get really, really into Hindu theology and read all the people arguing about it, and then if I were to get really, really into Catholic theology and do the same, at least one of those would have to be pretend, right? We'd have to admit, can't be both. I'll tell you about something else that I think is pretend. The doomsday clock. Do you know this thing? The Bulletin of Concerned Scientists puts this together, and now we're told the doomsday clock is 2 minutes to midnight. I'm fascinated with the acquisition of nuclear weapons. I listen to the Arms Control Wonks podcast. The Indians have the Agni 5 ICBM out that I want to know about, North Korea, of course. But your doomsday clock is a pretend clock. Tell me about the Indian ICBM. Spare me the news about your make-believe clock. You know, in 1983, a Russian general, Stanislav Petrov, decided not to report an alarm, and it probably prevented a Soviet counterstrike to a non-American strike. Back then, the doomsday clock was at 4 minutes to midnight. Really? When one Russian general decided, I think it's bullshit. We were worse off than we are now? During the Cuban Missile Crisis, the doomsday clock was 7 minutes to midnight. Really? It's that much further from midnight than we are now? It's a pretend clock. Real scientists, pretend clock. Back to Ross Douthat. He said this. He was talking about Catholicism in Europe, and he said that Europe has become a museum of Catholicism. And I knew exactly what he meant. You can go there. You can visit all the shrines. I know the Catholic religion was from Nazareth, but the first pope, Peter, took it directly to Europe. I understand it's not a lived experience, and that gave me an idea that America, I'm not instituting my own doomsday clock on this one, but it's a real danger, and it's this, that America is in danger of becoming a museum of democracy, where one day, that if some recent events, in fact, some that we just heard about, if some of those went down, we would be fast on the path to this society being but a museum of democracy. And then one day, tourists from around the world will come to our shores. And, you know, they'll probably wear more respectful, longer pants than the shorts they were attired in. And they will visit all of our sites. They will say to us, oh, you're an American. This is post-Trump America. You know, I visited Constitution Hall and I visited Gettysburg. And it's just so fascinating. It's just so beautiful. beautiful. And of course, I paid the suggested admission price. I'm not a monster. I put a few bitcoins in the collection plate because I know you guys want to restore the relics, the declaration, Obama's first inaugural, the map of that last ungerrymandered swing district. It's all very important, this Western European will tell you. And then they'll even tell you, you know, we went to the glass of collections of letters to the editor, such a thing, saying we were wrong to vote the way we voted, that we had information and we allowed the information to change our mind. I thought that was fascinating. The tour guide did mispronounce the phrase, respectfully disagree. So, I don't want to be too histrionic about this. I think we're at least 9 minutes to doomsday when it comes to this, but America could become but a museum to democracy. You know what we just found out is the number one guy who's stopping that? It's Don McGahn. I did not figure that would happen. On the show today, it is an Antan Twig, our three-week segment where we collect all the listener feedback. But first, from these northeastern climes, let us go across the country to the Pacific Northwest. Now, a little bit further down, a little bit further, right there, nestled in the coast. It's Portland, home of the series Portlandia, where Fred Armisen and my guest, Carrie Brownstein, have held forth for 8 years. If Then's a podcast about technology, society, and power. Each week, Slate's April Glazer and Willa Remus will take you on a lively tour of the tech news that actually matters, from fake news in your Facebook feed to the algorithms that want your job to the Uber drivers who want a job with benefits. Babies. On the show this week, the world of YouTube stars, a bit culty and a bit bro-y. Listen every Wednesday to If Then. The Defender is a beautiful car, but beauty is, of course, sometimes only skin deep. Not with the Defender. Let's talk about the interior. It's robust, built with integrity. Yes, it's designed iconically, the exterior. That's what compelled me. My neighbor Jay says, Mike, you see what's on the block? It's a Defender. And I look down the block, and indeed there is. And me and Jay, the neighbor, and Michelle, we gather around the Defender. We peer in the window. I have to say, I don't want to make this a little too tawdry, but we lust, or perhaps we gvel. To drive the Defender is to explore with greater confidence. We looked at the cargo capacity, more room for the gear. There's really a wide range of adventures. The Defender family features the two-door Defender 90, the Defender 110, and the Defender 130, which seats up to 8. Push what's possible with a vehicle made to go further. The Defender 110. Learn more at LandRoverUSA.com/Defender. The IFC show Portlandia is in its final season. In similar news, the actual city of Portlandia will be shutting up and becoming Indianapolis. It's kind of sad. I was thinking about Portlandia. So if Black Mirror is the worst implications of technology that might exist 3 years in the future, some of Portlandia is the funniest implications of technology that exist 3 minutes in the past. Plus, the world's gentlest bands. One of the brilliant performers and creators of Portlandia, Carrie Brownstein, is with me here. She was also in a really good band called Sleater-Kinney. Hello, Carrie. How are you?
Hi, Mike. I'm good. How are you?
Are you sad about this?
I am. It's bittersweet. We were in charge of it ending. We didn't get canceled. We felt like 8 years was a long time.
Euthanasia. That's very Portlandia.
Yeah. It is very much. It's very DIY. Right now, we're just in this kind of liminal space. It's going to really hit me, I think, in the spring when we would normally be writing again. Mm-hmm. And there's just this space, this empty space where Portlandia used to be. I must say that talking about it in the past couple weeks doing press has really made it feel more pronounced.
Right, because it's over for you. It's just not over for us.
Luckily now, you know, shows just have this sense of being a little more infinite. You know, they're not so much locked into time or space unless it's like, a sports or some kind of live program that you feel like you really need to watch it now to be part of the conversation. So many shows, you know, people, it's just right off the a la carte menu and people are kind of watching it at their own time.
So when you started, you're obviously a funny person, but not a person known for comedy. Did they have to sell you to IFC? Was there any, like Fred saying, you know, vouching for you?
No, although I will say, Fred was married for a while, and at his wedding, he had only one person speak, mm-hmm. and it was me. I was sort of the best man. And this was a wedding He was on SNL at the time, so there was a lot of heavy hitters, as you can imagine.
I think I know who he is married to.
Yeah, I'm sure you do. And so we have this room full of all of the SNL Illuminati at the time. You know, these just Tina Fey, Amy Poehler, literally just some of the funniest people, plus Lorne Michaels. And I didn't really know at the time. I was very nervous to just stand up and give a toast that was heartfelt, but also, you know, you want to be funny and make people laugh. And I did that successfully, and time went on. And Fred said, you know, that was kind of your audition for Lorne. I was like, what? What are you talking about? Then I realized it's kind of true. Like, I assume he would have been on board no matter what. But I think in that moment, he understood a couple things. One was that I had some kind of confidence that came from God knows where to get up in front of all these people and be the only one talking, even though there were people probably much better suited to, you know, giving a roast or a toast or whatever. And that also that he saw what Fred meant to me and what I meant to him and what could possibly come of that creatively.
Yeah.
So even though it was not a formal audition, I just think it allowed us to move forward with his blessing, and I think with a certainty on his end that what we were going to do and what he was a part of was going to be something special.
Is there, you ever play a character you hated? You couldn't wait to get out of her skin, not maybe even necessarily her makeup or his makeup, but just,
You know, not for myself. And I think that's part of the ethos of the show is that these characters are people whom we understand, who we relate to. Fred has a character, however, named Joey, who is this really garrulous kind of New York accent guy that is definitely based on Fred growing up in Long Island. I have written myself out of those sketches.
Huh.
I directed him as Joey this year, and it was a lot more fun to observe and direct him than it was to sit opposite him.
Did it give you hives? Did it make you nervous?
Yeah, it just that kind of, you know, lack of self-awareness with a kind of pedantic, you know, nature, and also just a certainty of rightness.
Somebody's got to say, I want my money back. That's all. I want my money back because I'm about to walk out of these things.
And Fred knows this. I mean, we've talked about it a lot. I like when he plays a character for him because I think it's such an interesting and kind exploration of that guy for Fred. But anyone playing opposite of him is very fatigued.
You must get serial killers in here, right?
God, I hope I haven't seen any killers. But
they chop people up, you know, because they're so sick.
Well,
they don't understand that, like, once you kill someone, that's enough. You don't have to keep going and chopping them up like they're in, you know, the deli.
Okay.
I think I and other New Yorkers think about that guy who could be your deli guy. What do you want? What do you want? Ham? What do you want? Ham on that? Eggs? You want eggs? Two eggs? They're just trying to be efficient. They're trying to do you a solid by not wasting your time. And I go to places like Portland, and they might have all the greatest intentions of the world, but goddamn it, coffee takes 12 minutes to brew.
You know what? I am with you on that. And I also think that over-communicating is not a bad thing. You know, I think that there's this kind of like reticent quality that people think of noble, you know, that it's noble somehow to just, you know, be silent. And I think you're right that, you know, thinking out loud, communicating, there's an efficiency. It also helps you understand, like when you're waiting around and someone's not telling you what they're doing, you're wondering, is it actually getting done?
Yeah.
If someone's walking you through the whole thing verbally, you know where they're at in the process.
Then again, the other side to that is the guy who checks you into the hotel and walks you through how every light switch works or how every thermostat works, which is a thing in Portland and Portlandia.
Yeah, for sure. So there, and I think Fred and I and all the writers on the show are really interested in that kind of minutia, that sort of performing tasks, performing personhood, performing couplehood. And so, yeah, that character, which you're describing is, you know, this hotel explanation gone awry. That's the thing. It's born of good intentions. And I think that that's usually what we're trying to get at is, you know, it reaches a level of absurdity or even surrealism, but the intention is to be helpful.
So much of Portland is born of good intentions. The feminist bookstore, they think that if people just bought books as they sell them, the world would be a better place. Or the every brunch place with rules about if your dog can have water or not, or be on a leash, all born of good intentions. And that's why it clearly comes across that it's all done with affection, even if you are making fun of them. And in some cases, the real life subjects have taken umbrage, I take it?
Yeah, you know, I assume you're talking about In Other Words, which is the bookstore. Yeah, so In Other Words is a nonprofit feminist bookstore slash kind of collective in Portland under whose auspices we shot our fictitious feminist bookstore, Women and Women First, for 6 seasons. Now, there is a oversight committee and a board that is in charge of all these decisions. And as with many organizations, you know, there's turnover and kind of a new crop of people came in and decided that they didn't want us to film there anymore. They just felt like we weren't aligned in terms of our philosophy and our thinking. Now, at the time, I remember a lot of people picked up on the stories, you know, kind of thinking like, oh, this is so Portlandia that these, you know, people,
right.
But we apologize and we respect your desires. And I actually ended up just donating a couple $100 to their organization and just saying, like, thanks for the good years.
I think that's the perfect response because, first of all, it's kind of perfect. Like, they are embodying what they're supposed to be if they say, you know, you've gone too far and some of these jokes are really hurtful. Like, that's perfect. That's totally in your personality.
Exactly. And, yeah. It's something that I really respect. And, you know, there's no reason to make it into something yeah. than just a conversation between two different entities. And we might not agree, but, you know, it's not contentious.
And in terms of comedy, maybe art, but all comedy, you know, a wall's funnier than some sort of trampoline.
Yeah.
If everyone in Portland is like, oh, we get the joke, it stops being such a good joke after a while.
Yeah, and I think it is, you know, it's tricky for people. You know, there's cities, bigger cities, that are used to seeing themselves reflected back via, you know, mass media.
Right.
And no one ever thinks that every show taking place in New York or Chicago represents every Chicagoan or every New Yorker.
Right.
That's impossible. These are diverse cities, are not monoliths.
Perfect strangers did, though, for Chicago. Just wanted to.
You know, you are definitely right. And WKRP.
Mm-hmm. That yeah, was
that
yes,
was
that
Cincinnati.
Spoke of.
That's actually the only Cincinnati I know. It's just a radio station and everyone lives inside of it. But you take a smaller city that it is a city that is self-conscious. It's a city that is sensitive. You know, Pacific Northwesterners we're a sensitive people. So, but we're also not all the same kind of people. So I get that, you know, all of a sudden they feel like the rest of the world is looking at them as if they're only these really precious, you know, over-concerned people. And they're not. It's just our take on it. And also, Portland was just kind of a stand-in for a mindset that definitely exists all over the place.
Well, that's the thing that happened over the 8 years. America, well, it's probably gone in a couple directions, but one of the directions is a lot of the cities in America and a lot of urban America and a lot of what you might call, you know, bohemian America, yuppie America has become much more Portlanda.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, in terms of our real lives kind of emulating what we do online, where what we do online is we filter out everything we don't want to hear or see. And we have these highly curated selves and we, you know, show people on social media a version of our lives that we kind of want to portray. And we cut out all the stuff that's unsavory. And people kind of did that in their neighborhoods. You know, they started making these like highly curated neighborhoods and just thought like, yeah, I want to be able to walk around and just get the kind of coffee I want that caters to my particular needs. And obviously what our show, I think, was actually doing, and we don't think of ourselves as separate from the people we're portraying, is really questioning the entire time, like, what is this idealism and ideology born of? It's kind of born of the privilege that let this ideology form in the first place, you know? And I think slowly some of, you know, in real life and also some of our characters started realizing, well, what are we cutting ourselves off from when we curate our lives so much? You know, when we sort ourselves away from other people that are not like us? And is there a benefit to coexistence?
But then I think that gives rise to this phenomenon where you do a Tough Mudder course, or like you're curating its experiential hardship as a vacation. That's kind of a weird thing.
Yeah, that's definitely like a very modern kind of thing where like we've distanced ourselves so much. Many, many people, not everyone, obviously, yeah. There's a ton of people working very hard jobs. Many of us, though, work, you know, jobs that don't require a lot of physical exertion, don't require quote unquote hardship. And so, yeah, we manufacture it. You know, we manufacture these experiences that emulate a previous time where we really had to sweat it out.
What's the least artisanal thing that you consume on a regular basis? You, Carrie, you.
I feel like I eat like a kindergartner.
Uh-huh.
I prefer pizza that's not very artisanal. I actually think there's a slight backlash where there's, now I see like mac and cheese on every menu. It's not like we're kind of returning to like diner style food because it's like got too far in the other direction. But
Sometimes the cheese is, you know, a Asaggio.
A Gruyere.
Yeah,
a Gruyere. Yeah. I don't know. pizza, I guess, is not very tap water is not very artisanal.
Me too. Tap water.
Tap water.
And I don't need a wooden bottle to drink it out of.
Yeah, and it's gluten free naturally. So
yeah, that was good. We were ahead of that curve.
Yeah, yeah.
I remember like 12 years ago, Cheerios marketed itself as cholesterol free, and I was like, was there ever a question? But now one of these trends about things you can't eat and all the things that were no one ever thought were gluten are putting their hands up like, we're gluten free. It's like, yeah, you're a fire hydrant. Of course you're gluten free. It's crazy. This is what I'll miss most with Portlandia going and leaving, the very specific observation that you don't realize so many other people have about a trend like gentle bands, you know?
Right.
It's a lot of the music stuff. You guys are so good on putting your finger on this musical trend and never skewering it. And I think you both have excellent credentials and no one will think that you're parachuting in and don't know what they're talking about or really trying to mock them. But it's so good. It's so precise.
Thanks. Yeah. Both Fred and I and then Jonathan Kreisel, who's our co-creator, we all came up at a time where music for us was so formative, really just was the lens through which we interpreted the world, kind of helped define who we, you know, were and who we are. We came up in very particular, like, punk rock scenes, self-righteous, but also really important, like really putting out a lot of interesting work. And I think we will always exalt that form and want to pay homage to some of the people that really influenced us. And yes, I think some of our most keen observations are about music and the particularities. It was so much a celebration of the things that we have affection for.
Kerry Brownstein of Portlandia, season 8, the final season, is upon us on IFC and then in Netflix. Not by DVD anymore, guys. Just stream that shit. Thank you, Kerry.
Thanks for having me on.
This episode is brought to you by The Jordan Harbinger Show. You've heard me talk about The Jordan Harbinger Show because it's one of my favorites. He does in-depth interviews with some of the world's most fascinating minds. I can name a few: Barbara Boxer, Anderson Cooper, Michael McFaul, the Ukraine or Russia ambassador talking about Ukraine. One I recently listened to was Stanley McChrystal, the general, the former general, and he told an interesting story about revering Robert E. Lee. But then, after having a portrait of him for 40 years, he's a 63-year-old man, throwing it in the trash. Because his wife says, you know, what that picture and that man means to you, it doesn't mean to other people, and you have to understand that. And then in the interview, they got around to the point where McChrystal talked about that interview in Rolling Stone magazine that pretty much ended his career, where it got to the desk of Barack Obama, and it had McChrystal saying unflattering things about the war effort and just how he talked to his wife and how they decided not to be bitter and not to wallow in it. He could have taken some shots at the process, the reporter, or the president at that point, but he didn't. It was just an overall good interview. It was facilitated by Jordan's excellent interview style. Whether Jordan is conducting an interview or giving advice to a listener, you will find something useful that can apply to your own life in every single episode of The Jordan Harbinger Show. That could mean learning how to ask for advice the right way or discovering a little mindset tweak that changes how you see the world. Search for The Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R, like the first three letters in hard, B-I-N-G-E, as in how you'll want to catch up on all the episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And now it's an Antan Twig. That is our made-up phrase. I will cop to that. That is our made-up word for a three-week period. Couple of things. Since I made it up, I could expand the definition. And yes, I know the last time we did this was December 1st. But let me just make my case here. A three-week period can expand between 2 months. In fact, statistically speaking, most three-week periods do. Think about it. So the last one was in December. This one's in January. I think it adheres to the spirit of the three-week period. Also, I was talking to John McWhorter, the brilliant host of Slate's Lexicon Valley, and I told him I made up this word. I copped to it for a three-week period, like a fortnight would be 14 days, so I wanted 21 days, and I told him it was Antan Twig, and he got it. He got it immediately. He was like, oh, yes, that's good. I could see where it'd be an Antan Twig. Very good. So with his seal of approval, I think he gave me his blessing. So we get into it. We get into all the letters that you sent, which were none because it's 2018. Actually, you did send at the very end, parcel post. I will be mentioning that. The emails, the Facebooks, the tweets. Oh, the tweets. And I do have to correct myself. In yesterday's spiel, I referred a couple of times to Larry Nassar, the disgraced doctor who molested hundreds and hundreds of gymnasts. And while I did say that he was affiliated with Michigan State, I also misspoke on a couple of occasions and said the University of Michigan looked into him and University of Michigan doctor. Nothing to do with the University of Michigan. It's Michigan State, whose president actually yesterday resigned over what Larry Nassar did. And another correction, and this one I appreciate, this one comes from Ben Utter. I had made a reference to St. Stephen, his body being riddled with arrows, not St. Stephen. I was thinking of St. Sebastian, but now you're saying, wait, but St. Stephen, that guy's a Catholic saint. No doubt he died in a horrible way. Of course he did. He was stoned to death. And still, his relics, his portrait, often depicted with three stones, one on each shoulder, one on the head. Very sensitive, St. Stephen. St. Stephen was Jewish, and he criticized some of the elders of Judaism who were anti-Jesus, and he was tried, and he was stoned to death. And because he was Jewish, if you know this about the Jewish tradition, sometimes you visit a grave, and you know you put a stone on it to say, I'm here. I'm wondering if his family did that, or if they thought in that particular case it was insensitive. Should I not be making these jokes too soon? The guy died in 34, not 1934, 1830, just 34. He died in 34, born in 5, died in 34, which is like middle age back then. Those were the corrections. Soon I'll get to more of the generalized feedback. But I have to tell you what's gotten my goat during this three-week period. There is a series of ads that feature a trend that bothers me. Here, let me play this audio from an ad for a medicine called Symbicort.
Symbicort could help you breathe better, starting within 5 minutes. Symbicort doesn't replace a rescue inhaler for sudden symptoms.
Okay, now here's what's going on in the screen. What you think is going on is some doctor lady is talking about all the things that Symbicort does to you and maybe some of the things that are bad. And indeed, it is a doctor lady, but it's a specific kind of doctor lady. It's a cartoon wolf. The female doctor is portrayed as a cartoon wolf. It's motivated. Earlier in the ad, there's this huffing puffing thing, and so there's a wolf motif. It just seems weird to me that at some point the cartoon wolf can say something like this.
Symbicort contains formoterol. Medicines like formoterol increase the risk of death from asthma problems.
That there's someone out there who's walking around saying, well, I would have died but for those wise words of a cartoon wolf. But that's not actually the trend that bothers me. Here, let me show you or play for you another example of that trend.
I'm a robot vacuum cleaner, so yeah, I got 1 gig. I suck up dirt.
Okay, well, first specific problem to this ad, if you are a vacuum, you make that vacuuming noise, and we hear that, but you're also talking. So I'm not understanding, like, is the talk hole your vacuum noise hole, or is the vacuuming noise we're hearing? How can you both be talking of vacuuming unless it's like to a vacuum, vacuuming is making a noise out of some other part of the, shall we say, body? That's not the trend. The trend is this. Do you hear both those voice actors? They made absolutely no effort to get in character. And it's not their fault. There is this trend in voiceovers. It used to be the stentorian voice, Excedrin for headaches. But then it became the regular guy or the regular gal. Sure, the female wolf, she sounds pretty accomplished. She probably does Peloton. She's a high achiever. You know, she blows down pigs' houses on the weekends. She is a wolf. But it's the regular approachable person. And that's fine. These people, these voiceover people get hired to do this. My friend Luke does this every once in a while. I'll be watching an ad for the Amazon Fire Stick and it'll be Luke's voice. But if they told him, hey, you are the Fire Stick, I think the first question he would ask is, well, how do you want me to do it? And maybe these voice actors ask the director, so how do you want me to be the vacuum or the cartoon wolf? And the answer is nothing. Don't do anything to be the vacuum. You have to do something. Especially with wolf and vacuum. If the part, all right, you'll be playing an eggplant in this ad. And if you just want to do that as your regular voice, I think that's fine. No one knows what an eggplant sounds like. But a wolf, and a vacuum, they have distinctive sounds associated with them. To not incorporate those sounds into the portrayal is commercial malpractice. Okay, moving on to my show specifically, The Gist. You listen to it. Kerry Farrell writes in, I was interviewing an author, Russell Shorto, and we were talking about a historical revolutionary figure who was a shoemaker. And then Russell Shorto said, yes, he and John Jay cobbled together, and I didn't say anything about that. And you're right. If you ever hear an opportunity for me to make a great pun and I don't make it, do let me know. I need to collect these things. Another correction. I originally said that Eric Burdon, the Animals cover version of Nina Simone's Don't Let Me Be Misunderstood, according to Rob at SGH, other way around, the Animals covered Nina Simone. Matthew, or actually, as I read this more closely, Matt Jew writes in, I was talking to Maria Konnikova, made a reference to the vegetable succotash. The vegetable succotash. Matt writes, and this echoes something that Sandra Gustafson noted to us on the Facebook page, facebook.com/slategist. Succotash is a medley of vegetables based in corn and lima beans, not a vegetable. And there was a good subject line, subject, suffering succotash. In fact, he was. Moving on, Paul Steffen writes in to me when on the show I was wondering if my son Milo had made up his own joke or was stealing this idea from someone else, maybe Jimmy Kimmel, who he likes. The observation was that the subtitle of all the recent Star Wars movies seemed to be forming a sentence because they are The Force Awakens and then The Last Jedi. And he joked that perhaps the third movie will be called on Tuesday, The Force Awakens, The Last Jedi on Tuesday. Now, Paul wrote in and said, I don't know the origin of the joke, but I just want to note it's very similar to the conceit of the last chapter of If on a Winter's Night, a Traveler by Italo Calvino. Yes, my 10-year-old loves Italo Calvino. You know, I thought at first maybe he was ripping off the Gnostic Gospels, Hypostasis of Archons from Codex 2. But no, you're right. It was Italo Calvino. And that's a Jimmy Kimmel where Milo got the joke. And I learned something from Deborah Seligman, who told me that knee, when you say, I hope I'm saying that right, I didn't learn the pronunciation, is it nay? But when you say someone's name, a woman's name, nay, a different name, Jacqueline Kennedy, nay, Bouvier, for instance, to note the maiden name, has specific meaning in French, and it means born. And so when I said that the porn star Stormy Daniels, nay, Stephanie Clifford, our listener Deborah Seligson said, that's probably incorrect. But when I went on to say, and then she called herself Peggy Peterson for contractual purposes, it is certainly wrong to say that Stormy Daniels, nay, Peggy Peterson. I was using nay wrong. So I tried that. I tried that gambit. And you know what Deborah Seligson said? Nay. And now we get to the Lobstar. The Lobstar of the Antan Twig, given to the best listener, the best tweeter, the best Facebook interactor, and this is the physical product that I mentioned. Came in an envelope with a lot of postage on it, at least $7 worth of postage. It wasn't heavy. It was soft, this envelope from the United States Postal System. It was perhaps a little scary. You get a little scary when you get an envelope, but a little excited. And I opened it up, and I found out that it was a T-shirt. And the T-shirt was a picture of Donald Trump, and it was a quote he gave at the candidates' forum aboard the Intrepid. Picture of Trump and these words. When I do come up with a plan that I like and that perhaps agrees with mine or maybe doesn't, I may love what the generals come back with. That was sent to me, made up by and sent to me, well, made up by Donald Trump, but put together by Ryan Gauchy. I hope I'm pronouncing your name right. And that is because Ryan Gauchy, G-A-U-T-S-C-H-I, for that large and extra large T-shirt of that large and extra large buffoonery, you, sir, are the Lobstar of the Antan Twig. And that's it for today's show that just was produced by Pierre Bien-Aimé, who sports an apocalypse abacus. Just senior producer Mary Wilson has invented the Kablooey Sundial. Get your Kablooey Sundial wherever sundials are sold. Steve Lickteig is executive producer of Slate Podcasts. He also wears a whoopsie-daisy wristwatch. 10 to 8, all the time. The Gist. It is here that you will find the original Fiery Hellscape Egg Timer. Set it and forget it. Oom-pru-de-pru-du-pru, and thanks for listening.